Some months, you're flooded with jobs and make multiple placements. Other months, a big fat zero. This feast and famine cycle isn't just stressful, it's holding you back and keeping you from real predictable growth. Here's the good news. There's a reason it's happening, and you can fix it. The 7-Figure Freedom Scorecard is a free tool designed for recruitment business owners. In less than 10 minutes, it evaluates your firm across the 6 key pillars of sustainable growth: clients, candidates, team, operations, marketing, and strategy. Your personalized scorecard will reveal what's working and what's broken, and the fastest way to build a recruitment business that generates consistent 7-figure revenue month after month. Stop riding the revenue roller coaster and take the free scorecard now at recruitmentcoach.com/scorecard.
Why has that prospect invited you or accepted your request for a meeting? Now, something you've done or said in your outreach has triggered something that they're not happy about. Now, they're not going to tell you what this is. You know, that's your job to uncover that particular point. But I can tell you this, they're not happy with their current recruiters. So something you've said has triggered them to say, let's meet and discuss this.
What's the secret to winning retained and exclusive work? It isn't perfecting your pitch. It's asking the right questions.
If you're talking like a recruiter, you're just asking, have you got any jobs that I can fill? If you're talking like a management consultant who specializes in talent acquisition, you change the dynamic of the conversation. You start to bring it round to, let's talk about the challenges that are there. You know, when you hire somebody, what does it really mean? Is it just filling a place on your bench? Or are you actually looking to bring in the next level high performers?
I'm Mark Whitby, and you're listening to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. My guest today is James O'Brien, the Managing Director and COO at iIntro. James has been in recruitment since the late 1980s, and for the last decade has helped hundreds of recruitment firms transition from contingent to retained and engaged assignments.
Transactional recruitment is dying. You need to sort of build service and value into your proposition in a consultative way.
In this episode, James delivers an absolute masterclass on consultative selling.
Recruitment's not the problem. Retention is the problem because it's not something that's measured by internal talent acquisition teams. Unfortunately, it's a stat that is not measured by many recruitment firms either.
He breaks down the 3 key questions recruiters should be asking during discovery calls to reframe clients' thinking. Questions that reveal the true cost of a bad hire, disrupt the client's comfort with their current approach, and make them receptive to learning about your solution.
When you ask an employer, of the last 10 hires you've made, how many have reached their first year anniversary? Almost all of them will give you the same type of answer, 7 or 8. But you take that statistic as an employer and say that means 20 to 30% of your new hires fail.
If you want bigger fees, more exclusive assignments, and consistent billings, this conversation will change how you run your client meetings. All right, James O'Brien, how are you?
I'm very well, Mark. It's good to see you again. And as I said to you off air, hey, it's good to see us both sporting beards, but yours looks a bit better than mine, I think.
I decided to join the club of which you are already a member. So listen, I don't know how many years we've known each other. It's been,
at least
10, do you think?
At least 10, yeah. Okay. That type of number, yeah.
So last time you were on the podcast was March 2022. And that was a really popular episode. That was one of our top 10 of the year. I don't know if you know that. It was called How to Pitch and Win Retained Projects with Confidence. And it was very, very popular. I don't know why it took us so long to get you back on the show, but I'm glad we're doing it now.
No, I'm delighted to be. And time flies, hey, when you're enjoying yourself. And lots of the topics I want to talk about today will probably be a follow-on. And without it meaning to be an advert, go back and have a look at one of those previous episodes because you've got a great back catalog, Mark. It's just some amazing.
Absolutely,
guests.
Do you know what we've been doing this for 6 years now, which it's just flown past. So, James, give me a short update on what's been going on in your world since we last caught up.
Yeah. Well, if we think about the recruitment market over the last 3 or 4 years, I'm sure we both agree there have been some amazing changes. I'd like to say they're all positive, but I think the market has taken a bit of a kicking. Everything sort of seemed to go more so early part of last year, you know, that the whole conversation piece was around AI. And I think, you know, we've all got caught up. And I don't mean to say it's the hype of AI, but I think as recruiters, we possibly got overwhelmed by AI, just hit. And then there was almost that, you know, like the rabbit in the headlights, you know, recruiters thinking, well, I need AI. But they didn't necessarily know what it did for them or what it would do for them, whether it would improve their bottom line or whether it would just actually increase their costs. And, you know, I think we're starting to see some of the outcomes of that. So I think, you know, a lot of things have changed over the last few years. But I think, you know, they say timing's everything in most things that we do, whether it's the time when you actually reach out to a client and actually pick up that deal with them, whether you're trying to close a deal, whether you're trying to do a merger or an acquisition, it's all to do with timing and great business. I think, yeah, timing is one of those things that we sit on. And, you know, when I say we've known each other for 10 years, Mark, you know, our message has been consistent. Your message, our message, you know, we're very aligned in terms of what we do. That's why it's great to sort of share this this forum with you. But I sometimes think that maybe we were too early. Yeah, too early in the sense that people really didn't believe change was going to happen. You know, we've got the benefit of hindsight now. One of my little favorite expressions, I think I've got a PhD in hindsight because I know everything that's gone on in the past. But what I see there is in terms of we were trying to bang the drum that, you know, the market will shift. Transactional recruitment is dying. You know, now I know that's a fairly bold statement, but you need to sort of build service and value into your proposition in a consultative way. So one of the things I've seen change since the last time I met, and I'm not going back over the 10 years, so last week, is possibly the realization that you really do need to do something different, because with all the changes that technology are bringing to the solution, recruiters are under threat. Now, I don't sort of jump on the bandwagon that says, oh, you know, recruitment's going to die and disappear. In no way, shape or form whatsoever. But I do see that you know, people now recognize that if you're just going to go out there and say, I'm faster and quicker than everybody else, then the reality is you're not really going to succeed on that one. You know, not in the long term. You know, you can make a few bucks here and there, but, you know, the reality is you need to do something different. So I think 100%. When I look at it overall, yeah, great. I think when you look at it overall, yeah, the recruitment market has changed. The market is now changing belatedly and people are realizing it. And I think people are talking to you. They're talking to us about, how can I increase my value proposition? And I know that's a bit of a broad statement, but what can I do that's going to make clients come back to me time and time again? And it's that recognition that you know, you've got to do something different. So I think those are some of the changes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's funny. I think one of our earliest conversations was around value proposition and differentiation. And I know that is a theme that we've both been focused on helping our clients with for a long time. It used to be that, like, you're thinking about the competition or how do you differentiate yourself from other recruitment agencies, right? That was the old way. And then it was, how do you differentiate yourself versus the talent acquisition team that is, you know, wanting to keep as many of the roles in-house as possible to cut costs? And I think now the conversation is, although those both are still relevant to some extent, how do we differentiate from, you know, automation and AI tools, which purport to replace, you know, external recruiters? And so the value proposition and differentiation piece is probably more important than ever before. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's always been an issue. It's just the external forces, you know, the internal talent acquisition teams, for example, they now have access to everything that recruiters got. You know, so the question comes down then to looking at the market. Where are the challenges that the people see? And so I think some of your messaging, some of the outward messaging, call it branding, call it marketing, whatever you will, has got to look at the, you know, talent acquisition teams' primary focus is to fill the roles that are there. So they're job fillers. And the reality is, and, you know, people in certain, you know, talent short markets may disagree with this, but, you know, recruitment doesn't have a talent problem. It actually has a process and accountability problem, because you know, the reality is when recruiters reduce hiring risk, everything else for them will improve. So it's about showing the potential client, you know, they're probably a prospect at this stage, that it's not just about, you know, can I find people better or faster than your hiring team, but actually the service, that the process and accountability that sits beyond that, behind that, will differentiate me, because I'll stand behind my fee. An internal talent acquisition team, and I've spoken to quite a few of them, as probably you have, you know, their metric is, you know, we fill all the vacancies, you know, as best we can. But they don't look at the other particular part, and they don't, you know, they're an internal service, but they don't really have an external focus. And what we have to do is help the employer look at the big challenges, you know, and I've always said this to you, and, you know, again, I think it's something that you share. Recruitment's not the problem. Retention is the problem, because it's not something that's measured by internal talent acquisition teams. And unfortunately, it's a stat that is not measured by many recruitment firms either. They don't really look at it. And one of the drums I've been banging on over the past year is how people need to understand how they can use their retention rate to monetize it to, you know, increase their fees, which is an important area, but more importantly, how to bring clients into their sphere of influence and actually share with them what the challenges are. So that's when the recruiter starts to talk about what they can do that's different, that's going to make an impact in that organization. And yeah, that's where this retention issue is really important, because then you're talking to them. You know, one of the phrases we talk about, Mark, is if you're talking like a recruiter, you're just asking, have you got any jobs that I can fill? If you're talking like a management consultant who specializes in talent acquisition, you change the dynamic of the conversation. You start to bring it round to, let's talk about the challenges that are there. You know, when you hire somebody, what does it really mean? Is it just filling a place on your bench? Or are you actually looking to bring in the next level high performers? You know, so we all know in general terms, that the longer you retain somebody in your organization, you only retain good people. So retention is a really good metric to drive profitability and performance in organizations, and therefore reduce the cost of hiring, because you're not hiring as frequently. Now, that might sound counterintuitive to recruiters, because we want more recruitment. So sometimes, and one mark I remember on this one years ago, I was talking to a real estate recruiter, and or as we'd call it in the UK, estate agency recruiter, but they're trying to Americanize themselves and calling it real estate. And they said, well, listen, we don't care if people leave after 6 months, because it just gives us more jobs. I said, well, you're looking for the market to keep on moving, because the clients you're working with, they will eventually look to find to blame somebody for the fact that the people only stay 6 months, and they won't blame themselves. They'll blame the recruiter. They'll look in your mirror and say, you're the reason. So they'll move through. So I think it's a short-term focus for organizations that are growing. You know, those are the clients you want to work with. You want them to come back to you time and time again, because when you place people, they stick. And again, I've got some metrics we'll talk about later.
So look, this is a huge takeaway right there, is thinking about the fact that retention should be a key metric that we measure, that we talk about with prospects and clients, and underscores the value that we're delivering, because we're not just going to fill a job. We are going to place the right person who's with you long term and ultimately drives more value creation and potentially is promoted within the organization as well. I think I've been influenced by you on this topic, and we now recommend to all of our clients that they start measuring and tracking, or even historically reviewing, out of all the placements you've made in the last, you know, 36 months, let's say, how many are still with the client? And it takes a bit of time, but it's pretty simple to just look at LinkedIn, right, and track people you've placed. Are they still at the company you've placed them with? And are they still in the same job, or have they been promoted? And of course, going one step further from that would be, ideally, we're still in regular touch with all of our customers, so we know anyway. That's a whole nother conversation, is with that transactional recruitment versus consultative, is, you know, once you've filled the job, have you moved on, or are we keeping in close contact with both the client and the candidate to ensure the success of that appointment? But so the first level of this is, let's just start measuring. And then you've got real evidence and statistics to share with prospects to demonstrate that although your fee might be slightly higher to others that they're speaking to or the incumbent, the actual cost of recruitment with you will be lower because, as you say, they're recruiting less frequently and the person is having a greater impact. So the ROI of that placement is going to be greater. And I feel like we could even take that one step further. So one thing that we encourage our clients to do, James, is create case studies of successful placements based on the commercial impact or results that those individuals have had at the employers where you've placed them. So what does it mean? So like a lot of, well, not a lot, very few recruiters actually create case studies in the first place. So even just doing it at all to any extent is going to be a competitive advantage. However, when I do see case studies, a lot of them are much more about filling the role and time to fill. So for example, they'll say, we recently helped this manufacturing company to fill a, you know, head of operations role within 32 days or whatever, right? And so I think that is beneficial to an extent in that it shows you have filled similar types of roles before and that you've done it faster than they've typically been able to do it on their own. So that's all fine. But what would be even better is following up with that head of operations 3, 6, 12 months later, both the head of operations and whoever they're reporting to, and ask questions about how's it going? What have you achieved? Like, what's been, where have you had the most impact? What are you most proud of? Where have you been recognized? And so on. And teasing out the specific measurable difference that that person has made, because then you're able to go back to the case study and update it to say, you know, we helped this manufacturing organization to achieve A, B, or C, you know, tangible, measurable impact. Sorry, go ahead.
There's so much to unpack there, and I want to give some practical hints, if you like, to people. But I just want to pick up on the because that point you make about the testimonial, the case study, the first version, time to fill for them. They're like recruiter statistics, and it's sort of, you know, I mean, I'll say, so what? You know, it's like a bragging rights. I'm not saying there's not a place for it, but whereas the version you talked about is customer focused, not recruiter focused. It's talking about the impact that the hire that we made, and it was such a great hire. And a recruiter can't do that, Mark, because a recruiter is basically filling jobs. It is more of the management consultant who's specializing in talent acquisition can do that, because they'll have the relationship with the client, because they'll be the trusted partner, which is obviously the goal for everybody. So they can go back in at those periods of time. There are ways you can build that into your process, you know, because I said it's all to do with process earlier on, that you can do that. Now, one of the little things I want people who are listening to this, if they're recruiters, and I'm going to give a tip for recruiters, I'm going to give a tip for employers here. So as a recruiter, and I ask this question a lot when we're running training programs with our clients, and I ask them a question because they generally don't know it, but I'll ask the question that we just spoke about. I'll say, listen, you know, whether it's over the last 36 months, but I'll just say, just tell me of the last 10 placements you made. Yeah. Think about the last 10 placements you made in 2025, you know. Or maybe go back to 2024, depending on when people watch this. But, you know, go back to 2024 if this is early part of 2026 when you listen to this. The placements you made in 2024, where are they today? Now, shame on you if you haven't been tracking, but take that as an action point today. Track your placements. You know, track what they do. Like I say, they get promoted. That's a positive thing. But if you've not been staying in touch, it's almost, you've seen someone's promoted. You're sort of, ambulance chasing to say, hey, congratulations on your promotion. Can we help you hire anybody else, your replacement? You know, it sounds a bit, if you've not been staying in touch, but you should be. Now, when I ask that question, many of you say, well, most of them. I said, what does most of them mean? And they'll say 8 or 9. I say, great. Now, occasionally you get people to say 9 or 10. I say, listen, that's fantastic. How are you monetizing your really good success rate? If you've got a 9 out of 10 hit rate where people stay for a year, because a year is the crucial point, because in the first year, that's when you establish where people are at. You know, in terms of the rebate period that is currently offered by the vast majority of recruiters, you know, the rebate period protects your invoice It doesn't do anything to do with retention. It just means because after 90 days, you know, people, when you find out when do people leave in the first year, it's not in the first 90 days. It's in the first 180 to 270. It's in that 6 to 9 month period, because that's when you really find out, is this person the right type of hire for our organization? So the rebate period is meaningless in my view. Yeah, it's protecting your invoice. It's not actually helping the client anyway. But if you've got a great success rate, you know, and again, it's one of the things we talk about. We talk about extending, you know, we call it free replacement rather than rebate period. But, you know, we offer our clients up to 12 months free replacement. So we recommend that our clients offer their clients, employers, up to 12 months free replacement, which is a game changer. You know, and recruiters will sit and say, oh, that's crazy. I don't control that. Well, no, you don't control it, because as soon as you've handed off the invoice, you've handed off the relationship. You've not got any interest in how that person performs. Whereas your story there, taking the case study, Mark, taking that to market and actually talking about the impact on the commercialization of the organization, what that's done, the ROI, et cetera, that's amazing. So I'd question recruiters to look at their own fill rates. And if you're really good at it, figure out how are you commercializing that? How are you monetizing that particular rate? So that's that side. Now let's just switch to the employers, if I may. And as an employer, ask yourself the same question. Of the last 10 hires we took on from whatever source, internal, external recruiters, talent acquisition team, yeah, how many of those people are still there? Now, I'm fortunate, Mark. I actually work a lot with our clients in their clients. Yeah, I sit with them on calls or in meetings. And the information I'm going to give you is going to sound anecdotal, but it's based on thousands of responses. Yeah. And when you ask an employer, of the last 10 hires you've made, how many have reached their first year anniversary? Almost all of them will give you the same type of answer. And that answer is 7 or 8. Yeah, 7 or 8 out of 10. And the reason why they give us that number, even though it may not be strictly accurate, because stats will say it actually might be a little bit worse than that, but yeah, the reality is the reason they give us that number is what I call the psychologically safe number. Because Mark, if we go back to our school days, which for me was many, many years ago, I remember if I'd ever come home from school and had an exam result where I'd got, let's say, 75% in an exam, that was good. You know, 7 to 8 out of 10 is good. You know, so people feel positive about it. So it's a psychologically safe number. But you take that statistic as an employer and say that means 20 to 30% of your new hires fail. Now, where have you hired them from? And if they're using external agencies, that's the case. So, you know, if you're a recruitment agency and ask yourself a question and you're 9 out of 10, well, just know that the rest of the market who don't care about their client relationships, it's 7 out of 10. And it's a question you've got to say, why is that? And it's our processes are not strong enough to do that. And my killer question for any employer, you know, and this is a really good one, is, you know, if you've just told us you've got a 20 to 30% failure rate on your hiring, do you have any other process in your business right now today where you'd accept a 20 to 30% failure rate and just let it carry on running at that huge level? Now, what you want to be doing is working with a recruiter who's got a success rate of 90% plus. And again, yeah, drum roll, because I'm going to sort of, yeah, promote our intro here. Our client base, our clients who offer our type of service and value proposition and, yeah, high-level support, they have a 96% one-year retention rate, and 93% of all hires are still in the job 2 years later. And that's the thing that gives them the confidence to offer 12-month free replacement. But it doesn't happen by accident. It happens by hard work and diligence and actually putting in place a process that measures and tracks those. And I think the point you took on then is then how do you commercialize that again even further? Do your case studies, get them on your website, show your clients. You know, this old Zig Ziglar playing. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And you care about the client's performance. So we've got to bring that into the equation, I think.
I love this, James. There's a lot to unpack here. So first, thank you for sharing those killer questions, because I think they're super powerful. So let's just refresh on that, because I want people to really understand how powerful this is. So first question was, out of your last 10 hires, how many are still with you today? And you're anticipating they're going to say 7 or 8 now. And I understand the psychology behind that, because usually in a lot of areas of life, if you have like a 75% success rate, you consider that good enough that's acceptable, if not very good, right? Depending on the context. Now, and then the follow-up question is, where else? So you flip it so that they're thinking of it as a good thing and you reframe it into, well, actually, that means that 20 to 30% of your hires are not successful. So your hiring process is failing 20 to 30% of the time. So you reframe the whatever statistic they give you and then ask the follow-up question, which is there any other part of your business where a 25 to 30% failure rate would be acceptable and where you wouldn't be doing everything in your power to try and resolve that? So I love this. I love this questioning process. If I can dig in a little deeper, are there situations where the client just point blank doesn't know? Like they say, I have no idea.
Oh, yeah.
And so how would you, in that case?
Yeah, that, to be honest, the real answer, Mark, is when you ask that question, you will get people saying, I don't know, it's not something we track. That is probably more common the answer than the answer of 7 or 8. So we have to do our job in sales here, in terms of when we're trying to talk and, encourage information from the client, is saying, okay, well, just give me your best guess. What do you feel like? Just think about the people. And so their best guess is the 7 or 8 out of 10 in as many instances. And so you say, is that usual? Do you think that's normal? Because and sorry to the employers, our job here is to make friends with you. So we're going to encourage you and give you all the love that says, hey, listen, that's good. Now, I'm just going to give people a stat from the US market. 46% of new hires, according to an organization called Leadership IQ, and it's updated, but even though this is old stats, 46% of new hires fail in the first 18 months. So when we're saying 2 or 3, we're not saying 4 or 5, we're saying 2 or 3. So the real answer for employers is it probably may not be as good as 7 or 8, but 7 or 8 is the psychologically safe. For those people in the UK who watch Strictly, the old board that comes up and says 7, or 8.
Strictly combative,
you've done well. I can't remember what it's called. Is it Dancing with the Stars or something like that in the US?
Yeah, that's it,
But when they get them, and it's a good number. 7 or 8 is good. It should be celebrated because it is really good. So celebrate that with the client. It is really good. But is it good enough? Yeah, and if you if you're just accepting that failure rate, and again, when you say to people, why does it? Why is that? They'll say, well, it's people, isn't it? People. There's so many variables with people, there's emotions and all those type of things. I say, well, yeah, it's true, but if we look at what you do as a business, how has your business changed over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years? And they'll always say, well, it's changed dramatically. And then you ask another follow-up question to the employer. And again, if employers are listening to this, ask yourself this question yourself. But recruiters can ask this question. Say, how has your recruitment process changed in that same period? So, Mark, you tell I've been in recruitment a long time. Yeah. The point is, when I look back on it, how did recruitment happen in the 80s, 90s, and early noughties? And how much has it changed? Well, the answer is it hasn't changed much. We take a job on, we get some CVs or resumes, we'd submit them to the client. In my day, that was by fax machine before email got invented. And then the client would interview 2 or 3 times around the team and then make a hiring decision. Yeah. How has that changed? Now, it hasn't. It still happened. That process, if you ask your client, what's your process? They'll probably describe something broadly similar to that. So now your business has changed beyond recognition. Your processes have all been updated, upgraded, supported, reinvented, reimagined, all of those areas. Why isn't your recruitment process going through that dynamic of change? And the reality is because recruiters who are complicit with employers just carrying on the same old process. And the point is, it's okay. Now we're saying do better. If you're a recruiter who's already got that 9 or 10 out of 10 success rate, show your clients, listen, if I improve that, what's the marginal gain? And that's, by the way, marginal is probably the wrong word. Because if you've got an 8, if your client says you're 8 out of 10, and I'm saying to you, our recruiters work at 96%, that isn't a 16% increase, that's a 20% increase because you're from 80. So it's a bigger gain than you think. And the financial impact is there. And when you start to show the financial impact to organizations, and we have a bad hire calculator that we use, which is great in meetings. It shows the cost of getting it wrong versus getting it right. And although you're not going to do that overnight in terms of that financial gain says, okay, if you can help me save some of that money, the fact is you might be charging me a couple of percentage points more than the everyday recruiter, but they fail 30% of the time. That's got to bring them back round to you. And you should be, if you're an employer listening to this, you should be talking to recruiters who know their retention rates and want to know your retention rates and help you improve on those areas.
This is powerful, James. Great, great stuff. Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate here because, you know, some clients don't follow the ideal response, right? So what if they turn around and say, and again, it may be true or maybe not true, but they say, oh, 9 or 10 out of 10 are still with us, then where would you go from there? Because in their mind, or at least whether they truly believe that or they just don't want to admit to the problem, there's, you know, it gives us less of a problem to solve.
Yeah. Well, so a couple of points there. And one of them's going to be a little bit flippant in a hopefully humorous way, not as in an arrogant way. So generally, if we think about this as, and so again, I'm talking this from a recruiter perspective. If we all know, or we should know, that every time we get an opportunity to meet with a new prospect who will hopefully become a new client, that should be it's gold dust. You know, we really don't have enough of those. So yeah, our preparation should be to find out that. And you should have some idea by trawling through things like LinkedIn to see whether they've had any, you know, changes in hires. You should have some idea of what it may be anyway. So you've got that part, so you should know. Now, secondly, why has that prospect invited you or accepted your request for a meeting? Now, something you've done or said in your outreach has triggered something that they're not happy about. Now, they're not going to tell you what this is. You know, that's your job to uncover that particular point. But I can tell you this, they're not happy with their current recruiters. If they were, why would they look to change another? So something you've said has triggered them to say, let's meet and discuss this. Now, let's imagine you get the response back. And I have had it very, very, very rarely. You know, of the last 10 hires you made, how many are still with you? All of them. Here's my flippancy. Why am I here then?
You've obviously right, got a great exactly, work. Yeah. So I was thinking along the same lines. Like you say, wow, like it sounds like your recruitment process is running perfectly. So why are we even talking, you? Right?
Exactly. Now, don't shoot yourself in the foot here, Mark, because the reason might be is they might have a big expansion program and they're just looking to broaden their horizons to see what's out there. They may be thinking, we'll go out there. They may not be happy with the amount of money they're paying to their existing recruiters and maybe looking for a cheaper option, which isn't necessarily where we'd come in. But so yeah, you've got to listen. You've got to listen to the audience. You've got to use your ears and your mouth in that dimension and actually say what that is. So
you're quite right. Like, so client meetings are the lifeblood. Like, we want as much face time with existing and prospective clients as possible. And that's a metric that not enough recruitment agencies and recruiters are really tracking or really targeting themselves for. How many times per week are you sitting in front of a customer? And then when we get those opportunities, then I'm guessing that everybody is going to prepare as much as possible. So, you know, with, for example, LinkedIn Recruiter, if you have that or other tools, even Gemini or you know, or even just looking at LinkedIn and the company profiles and the employees of those companies before you go in there, how many people have they hired and how many people have left? And you'll be able to do your own, you know, calculation before you go so that you're still going to ask the question, but you know whether...
Yeah.
You know, it's
you shouldn't walk into you shouldn't walk down a blind alley on that particular one.
Yeah.
What you said there as well is, we talked about, you should be doing your preparation. I don't think everybody does it well enough, Mark. Personally, I think, I think that the challenge we've got is, I don't know what you hear, but, you know, getting meetings has become harder and harder. It's hard. You know, I was phoning up a prospect this morning. And I literally mean this. I'll say that I've already done the meeting. I think we did a great job. Doesn't mean he'll buy from us, but yeah, I think we did a great job. But I noticed he's not opened our proposal. And yeah, you know, so and I'm looking for the follow-up meeting. So it's maybe slightly different variant on this one. But nowadays, yeah, you know, so I phoned him up. I've got his mobile number, of course. I gave him a call. But I now hit the new, and I think it's the Apple version. Please leave your name and tell us why you're calling. Oh, hello, it's James O'Brien from my intro. Hi, Mark. He also happened to be called Mark. Hi, Mark. Just following up on the proposal. I want to make sure you've received it. Now, I know I've sent it, but I know he hasn't read it. Because we have all that those tracking tools nowadays, don't we, of course. But I had to go through his voicemail because it just wouldn't let me, it wouldn't connect me with him. So getting meetings has become more and more difficult. So why am I saying that? So when you have a meeting, don't underestimate how important it is, and don't underestimate how a lack of preparation you will shoot yourself in the foot, because somebody will do a better job than you. Because if they're seeing you, they may be seeing others.
I was just going to share that, I don't remember the exact quote, but it's something along the lines of people judge you based on the quality of the questions you ask rather than how intelligent you sound when you talk, right? And so even just conducting yourself like a management consultant, something you said earlier, and instead of just talking about recruitment type things, asking recruiter questions about the job description and the responsibilities and duties and, you know, all that stuff, asking more strategic, high impact questions that really get to the root cause of the challenges you're experiencing, the, you know, consequence or impact of those challenges, and so on, will go a long way to, you know, helping the client. What we want is the client to come away from that meeting thanking you for the meeting, right? If you can get clients thanking you for a sales meeting, then you've done a pretty good job.
In terms of, I think there's so many things there. It's all to do with when you prepare for meetings. Yeah, you've got to prepare for success, and you've got to ask the right questions, and you've got to ask them in the right order. And the reality is, when we take that to an organization, they start to look at you in a different way, because they realize you're not just there to fill a job; you're there to fix a problem. Yeah, and the problem, whether it's in the process or in the hiring, and for them, it's really important. And the piece I was going to say is, you know, years ago, one of the things I learned, and I was, the euphemism, I was in between roles. You know, if I was an actor, I would have been resting. Anyway, I was working with my brother-in-law, who runs a marketing agency. Yeah, or did run a marketing agency. He's retired now. And I was helping. That's probably, I was just watching. I was just trying to learn some ideas. But one of the things I learned from that marketing agency, and they were pitching at the time, they were pitching to an insurance company who were looking to launch through one of the retail brands here in the UK. And the contract value, or the opportunity, was probably worth about, in the first year, $1.5 million of revenue. And there'll be advertising revenue there, but, you know, it's a big number. And I looked at the preparation that this organization were doing. Yeah, and there were three people going into the meeting, and they were preparing, you know, visuals, all these things. And they weren't mock-ups. They were real, you know, physical things that you can touch like that. And they were taking them for this meeting. And his name was Gavin. I said, Gavin, how much did this all cost you? You know, because I was thinking, like, what's the cost of this? I wasn't thinking about what's the opportunity. You know, our mindset. And he went, it was probably going to cost me about 10 to 15 grand. I said, 10 to 15,000 to go and pitch? And he went, absolutely. I said, what if you don't win it? He went, what if I don't win it because I didn't put the effort in to show them what it's going to be like working with us? Yeah. So I want to show them physically what they're going to get. Yeah. So they could touch it and feel it in the meeting sort of thing. Now, I know a lot of meetings nowadays. I'm going back literally 11 years on that one. But I know that, you know, nowadays a lot of meetings are held in forums like this, in an online scenario. But one of the things I took from that, and it's one of the things we brought into our intro, is when you prepare for your meetings, and I'm not suggesting invest 10 or 15,000 in preparing for your meeting, but I am saying invest the time to prep. So don't turn up for your meeting without showing the client that you mean. But if you work with us, you know, I don't need you to, you know, I can help you visualize what's going to be, because I've done some things for you in my presentation, in my preparation. And I don't mean in your slide deck with a few PowerPoint fancy slides. We put some hard things into our process that show the client, if you're going to work with us, this is what we do. And one of the questions we ask is, do you work with any recruiters who provide you with this level of information and detail going forward? And the answer is, of course, no. And then the second thing is, so how would you feel about having that as part of your process to help you improve that gap, reduce that attrition gap from 30% down to as little as 4%? So all of a sudden, you're then getting around to the part you said, Mark, which is where that they say, hey, listen, thanks for that meeting. I really enjoyed it. I've taken something away that I didn't have before, and I look forward to meeting you again and doing business with you, whatever it may be.
So this is so powerful, because showing is better than telling, right? So if you can show them the value they're going to get, it's much better than you trying to just explain how good your service is.
Yeah, words that come out of my mouth, it's just a word bubble, isn't it? It's right. Gone, it's gone. And that's when recruiters say, hey, listen, our time rate to fill is 32 days or whatever you said earlier. Yeah, so what? That's not really, how's that really going to help me fix this problem? I'm looking to recruit a new head of operations for our manufacturing unit, we said. What can you do that's going to make it different? It's showing them things. And you can
tangible.
Do that.
That's
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Thing.
Even though it's electronic, even though the vast majority of meetings are going to be electronic, you can still show them things that make them say that. And what you're looking for is the wow factor. You want them to say, "Wow, I've never seen that from any other recruiter or organization that I've worked with." And that's where you've got to position yourself. And in the markets we go forward today, one of the things I said at the beginning, this consultative process, you're showing the client, like I said, not just telling them, you're showing them, physically showing them, this is what it's like to work with me. And one thing I'm able to say, and we focus on working in retained or exclusive recruitment where that the value is there. So, listen, I'm not chasing volume here. I can handle your volume, but I only work with one, maybe two new clients per month. I don't have time to deliver this level of service to them, which is why we're a premium product. We charge a premium price, but for anybody listening, clients buy premium products when they understand the value in that product. If they don't understand the value of the product, they'll buy the cheapest common product, which in recruitment terms is contingent recruitment, no win, no fee, placement only, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fraught with problems in its own way.
This is awesome, James. I love I've never thought of this before. The standard that you're setting for yourself in this client meeting is you want them to say, wow, that's a great... I've never thought of it that way before. And I'm thinking of my meetings and what we can do to, when people have that meeting, they go, wow, I've never seen this before. This, this is not like anything else that, your competitors have shown us.
If you just trip out of the room after the five recruiters and you just want the crowd, you might win your share of it. I'm sure you will. I said earlier about timing. I remember pitching iIntro one of the very first times, and it was in Belgium. And I was pitching to PepsiCo, and spoiler alert, we didn't win. probably down to my sales ability, but we were way ahead of the game, and we were showing this value proposition. Whereas the other probably 10 recruiters who were going through that day's dog and pony show, where you're sort of going through the mill, they did say wow. They said, wow, we've never seen it like this. This might be a little bit too far out of our comfort zone for us to do it. And we were so new, it's probably thinking, that won't work. When people say, that internet thing, that's not going to take off, is it? But here we are now, 10, 11 years later, and the reality is all those things are there. And what employers should be looking for is they should be looking for somebody who's innovative, progressive, forward-thinking, probably like them as a company. They're moving forward. And what are you doing to provide a 21st century recruitment process rather than the 20th century model that's still being peddled today by pretty much everybody? And you've got to show the client that innovations come there through things like AI and technology and all those things. I'm not underselling those things, but you bring them into the market so the client can see, hey, this is how we're innovating. And this is what we're doing. And this is what it will mean to you. The WIFM, what's in it for me? Or what's in it for them? When you look at, as a recruiter, you're talking to an employer. If you can't give them a tangible benefit of what it's going to be like to work with you that's better than everybody else, you're just another one. And what happens then is it becomes a pricing war. Who'll go lowest to win the work? And that'll go down to, it can go down to very, very low nowadays because people sometimes get desperate. But again, don't underestimate.
Here's what I keep hearing from clients who have switched to Recruiter Flow. They are executing faster, not working longer hours, but using a platform that just makes sense. Recruiter Flow is an AI-first ATS and CRM built specifically for recruitment agencies and executive search firms. No confusing menus, no endless buttons you'll never use. When someone new joins your team, they're up and running in hours, not weeks. And here's the thing. When your recruiters spend less time fighting with software, they spend more time doing what actually matters, having conversations with clients and candidates. Several of our clients at Recruitment Coach have made the switch, and they're telling me it's transforming their operations. If you want to see it in action, book a demo at recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. That's recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. Recruiter Flow. You already understand the benefits of posting video content on LinkedIn. The problem is time. After all, you're a recruiter, not a full-time content creator. Trusted Voice Video is built for busy recruitment business owners who know that video matters, but they don't want another job added to their plate. One 30-minute session per month gives you 30 days of short-form video content. We plan the topics, guide the conversation, edit the footage, and deliver ready-to-post videos. You'll never be stuck wondering what to say. You'll never worry about how you look or sound. We coach you through the session so you come across as clear, confident, and credible, even if you hate seeing yourself on camera. My colleague Sanjay manages the whole process. He already produces this podcast and my own video content, so if you like my content, then why not let us create yours as well? If you want your content working for you 24/7, head to recruitmentcoach.com/video and book a free strategy call.
That people will buy quality if you've shown them what it is.
This is awesome. James, can we go where from the strategic to the very tactical for a second? Because you mentioned about sending a proposal, and we do the same thing. So I don't know what platform you use. We have a platform called Proposify. Is that the one you guys use?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Okay. They're actually based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I'm from, which is part of why I chose them, because I was, and
I'm off to Halifax after this call, but not Halifax, Nova Scotia.
UK.
I'm off to Halifax, West Yorkshire.
It was partially for sentimental reasons, but it is a good product. There's another similar one called, it's escaping me at the moment. In any case, it tracks when people open the proposal and which pages they spent the longest on and how many times they opened it and all that stuff. So two questions around this. So one is, we've told our clients, if they want to win retained projects and especially multi-hire retained projects or mini RPOs or, you know, anything like that, then they need to put some time and effort into putting together a really wow proposal. And that should be introduced as part of their sales process. And one of our clients actually challenged that. And he was like, well, we win retainers every week without a proposal. And I was like, okay, what do you mean? He said, well, they should learn everything that they need to know from that sales meeting and buy into, and then you're sending the fee agreement for them to sign, and then you're in business. So he felt like the proposal was going to slow down his sales process. I wondered what your take on that is.
I'm probably more aligned with you than that client there, but here's the part. So when we talk about the preparation for the meeting, so there's some documentation that we present, things like candidate packs and whatever, which are all branded in the client's or prospect's brand. But when we're creating that, you know, it's you know, you're talking branding, imagery, all of those elements. We also say at the same time as you're doing the prep for the meeting that you haven't yet had, because most meetings you've probably got a week's notice or at least a couple of days, you know, but you know, it's rare somebody's going to phone me up and say, oh, could you come round and talk to me about some recruitment work at 3 o'clock this afternoon? Doesn't happen. Well, not in my world. So you've always got a bit of time. But at the same time, we say, listen, prep your proposal, because you know what your proposal is going to look like. And a lot of it will be standard. So you use Proposify, we use Proposify. So it's templated. And, you know, sometimes I feel, I don't know whether you feel this way, Mark, when I'm sending a proposal, I've had a meeting, let's say the meeting's finished at 1 o'clock. And because of my template, I know that I could probably finish the proposal in 5 minutes. I really could. But I actually quite often wait to because I want them to feel like it's, you know, I created this proposal for them, which I have. I've spent a lot of time preparing this proposal and the template. But I have changed the elements which relate to their business and all the things which, you know, no doubt you do too as well. But, you know, you can get those. So if I've done the preparation in advance, the proposal can come out quickly. It's not going to delay me. And I think more importantly is it's a reference point for the client, because when we're selling retainers into that, you know, sometimes you're relying on the person you've met to go and sell that internally for you. And there's always a naysayer in an organization. Say, well, why are you buying a retainer? Well, and if you've got nothing, say, well, look at this. And it's like, you know, the power of the written word, you know, in terms of you show them this proposal and it shows how, you know, what you're going to do, why you're doing it, how you're doing it, all of those elements that are in there in a very, you know, hopefully sexy format, which looks amazing.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. So it makes it easier for your champion to sell this internally, yes. Especially if it goes against the way they've traditionally done things, right? And because no one likes to really stick their neck out and be like propose something way out there and without, you know, because that's risky to their internal reputation, right? So it gives them ammunition for that internal sale.
And particularly if that recruiter is a relative unknown. You know, we talk about the tier one search firms in the old days. Let's talk computing, keep away from recruiting. You know, nobody ever got fired for buying from IBM in the good old days, yeah? If you're a recruiter who's called, you know, James O'Brien Associates, yeah, and you're asking for, you know, a considerable input from the organization to, you know, who are they? If you don't have any, you know, some credibility information to help to support your internal champion, they may fail. And I'll bet that anybody's listening to this has said, oh, I thought I won that deal. But then they came back the next week and said, oh, sorry, the CEO said we're going to be using their best friend's mates.
You know, right.
Or whatever. So we've all had that.
Yeah. I think the other thing the proposal does is it shows a level of rigor. Like, this is, we're serious. We know our stuff and if the proposal has the wow factor, then it is a sort of preview of how rigorously you're going to deliver on the project as well. So I think it does have that. Getting super technical here, James, I wonder about the psychology. You mentioned following up a proposal earlier where the person hasn't opened it yet. And I've often debated this myself. Is it better, do you think, to say, I wonder if you've had a chance to look at the proposal versus say, I noticed that you haven't opened the proposal yet. And I wondered, like, do you think it's better to let them know that your technology is able to see that and challenge them on it?
Yeah, there's a fine line there, isn't there? And it might, I mean, listen, for everybody listening today, you should know that technology enables all of this. So in reality, we all know that when we open an email or we open a proposal or whatever, everything's tracked pretty much nowadays. It sort of can feel a bit big brotherish, you know. So if, you know, I was phoning this guy today and I'm phoning, and I suppose I'll give you one of the other little reservations I've got with something like Proposify, Mark. And again, I don't know if you've experienced this, but has it gone into junk? Now, I know it probably hasn't because of the number of proposals that we've had accepted, which obviously don't get there. So it's not by standard, but maybe somebody's got a stronger spam filter. So I'm worried because, you know, with it, and again, my example on this one. So, you know, on Wednesday, I met up this guy called Mark, and I said, I'm going to send you a proposal later on today, which I did. Yeah, that was my commitment, and I did it. Yeah, partially because it was templated, so it wasn't the most onerous of tasks, of course. But, you know, I put that to him, and, you know, I tell a promise. Now, I looked yesterday, I was traveling, but I looked yesterday on the system on Proposify, and it says he hasn't opened it. So I sent him a little WhatsApp, a LinkedIn message last night. I said, hey, just want to make sure you got the proposal as I promised it was with you yesterday. And I checked this morning, and he still hasn't opened it. So I'm worried. So, yeah, so that's hence the call, you know, and I feel like, you know, you can sometimes feel like I'm negative to say, and I've told him on the call. So listen, I can tell that you haven't read it. Or opened it, sorry. You could have opened it and not read it, of course. But you've not opened it yet, and I just want to make sure you've actually got it.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure it hadn't gone into your spam folder or what have
just
you.
Just a moment ago, I lost you for about a millisecond, well, not a millisecond, but about 2 seconds, because he was ringing me back, and it was blocked that moment.
There you go.
He's ringing me back from that message where I had to go through the Apple sales prevention process.
Well, look, James, that also shows the importance of following up, right? And instead of just letting that, you know, after all the prep and the effort that presumably we and hopefully the listeners are putting into their meetings, and then you have a great meeting and then you send the proposal, like, you can't just leave it and hope that it just closes itself. It's the follow-up and picking up the phone, and it's great to hear that you are still doing that yourself.
Yeah, picking up the phone is really important. You know, for all of the things that the automation and tools have got there, and, you know, I've been on one of your automation programs, Mark, with your colleague, for all of those things, we are still in a contact sport and people buy from people. Like, we can't impress people much. Use all the technology. You know, technology will help you. It's it supports discipline, but it doesn't replace the judgment. And that's when you're speaking to people, that's when they can judge, are you somebody I want to do business with? And that's what's really important there as well.
Amazing. So we started out kind of under the general theme of people haven't got a recruitment problem. They've got a process and accountability problem. Is there anything else that we haven't discussed yet that relates to that particular heading?
No, I suppose one of the things, you know, and I focus a lot on retention, but retention for me equals reputation, because, you know, that's how you can demonstrate where, not any way you can add value, but where you can show the employer, the client, how they can generate value from working with you because you care about it. And that's, I say, all the more reason for you to stay in touch with that client, even if it's just a single placement. You know, and again, there's a lot of work happening at the moment, Mark. You touched on things like MSPs, mini RPOs, those type of things. There's some amazing projects out there at the moment. We're working with clients, you're working with clients, where there have been some great successes towards the back end of last year, moving into this year now. So it certainly is opportunity there. But yeah, that's where you've got to use these tools, this information, these questions to show the client what you can do to help them with these things. Because, you know, that reputational piece helps you become the trusted advisor. If you're trusted, they'll come back to you time and again, and they won't question your fees. You know, because, you know, if you, as long as your fees are fair, people don't mind paying fair. So I think that's cool.
What's what do you mean by if your fees are fair? Like, what does that mean in your mind?
Well, I'm not talking a percentage, a number here. I'm saying the client doesn't feel, you know, okay, I'll give you an example. I was out with my wife, and, you know, maybe this is a question of my wife. You know, we were buying a cup of tea somewhere. Yeah. And she obviously hasn't bought a cup of tea for a long time. And she was gobsmacked at the price of a cup of tea.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And I said, yeah. So the price to her wasn't fair. Yeah. Because it seemed out of kilter with what her expectation was. So what I mean by fair is if your fee is fair to a client, they're happy paying the fee. They're not begrudging it. You're not hearing gripes coming back from them. It's a number because it represents value for what you're paying for. And this cup of tea, which, you know, we all know a cup of tea is a boiling hot kettle and one little tea bag.
It's a few, you know, cents. It's a few cents.
We all know you're paying for the fact that you're sat in a cafe and you've got to pay for the
atmosphere tea.
Was out of kilter with her thought process. And just told me that, you know, because she was paying that day and I wasn't. It must be a long time since she's paid, because it didn't frighten me. It just not frighten me. Didn't it was fair to me. I mean, it wasn't cheap.
But it
was fair.
You're talking about psychologically, it's acceptable to the client. They feel like this is a fair deal. The exchange of value is one that they don't feel like you're
ripping them off. You're not ripping them off.
Ripping them off, right.
Yeah. And we all know that, you know, we've all bought things, so I'm not going there again, because I just felt like, ooh, I was overcharged for something that was, you know, average. So, you know, you've also got to look at your own internal service process here to make sure that you are delivering what you said, you are delivering value, you're checking in with the client, you're getting their feedback, you're bringing that through, so that it is fair. And if it's not fair, then they'll leave you, and you may not see it coming. And we sometimes call that what's the phrase we use? I've just forgot the phrase we use. Relationship fatigue. You know, you've got to be conscious of relationship fatigue, because you can just become complacent with your clients. And that's where sometimes in organizations, if you know, a lot of recruitment organizations are small, but sometimes you need to have a look at when you're account managing, is say, hey, listen, can you look at my accounts for me, please? And just tell me, am I missing anything? Because if you look at it yourself, that's where, because you just say, oh, I'm doing that. And you just slipped off. And not in a bad way, you just fallen away. So relationship fatigue is a killer for recruiters. So sometimes if you've got somebody to, yeah, a non-exec can be helpful to look in and challenge what you're doing, or, you know, one of your colleagues or partners, just to look at it and say, am I doing everything right here? Is, you know, missing something out? So you can
bring that example. So we've talked quite a lot about process. Can you say a little more about, when you talk about accountability, what are you referring to here? And is that accountability on the part of the recruiter, the client, or is it a bit of both? What are we really talking about?
Well, I think accountability for me is making sure that the client understands what your role is. So you're accountable for, you know, as a recruiter, I'm going to use this language, not bad language, there we go. As a recruiter, you're responsible for making the placement. As a management consultant who specializes in talent acquisition, you're responsible for making sure that person becomes a high performer in the medium to long term. So you're more accountable, and you should be able to build into your service level agreement the fact that I am going to check in after 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, just to check how things are going. Is that okay with you, Mr. or Mrs. Client? Yeah, of course it is, because you've got a relationship with them. So you're accountable for delivering the service value because you want to measure. And yeah, whereas if you're a recruiter, your only yardstick is, do we get past the 3 months? How many times have the phone call where the phone call's from the client and it's in the first 3 months? And it's not the recruiter thing. Oh, great. It's the client. Oh, my God. Why are they calling me?
Exactly.
To tell me that Billy's left. Oh, God. When did he start? Have we pitched the rebate? Did they pay within 7 days? Have they breached their terms? Yeah. Accountability is about helping the client understand this is what we do. And therefore, that's my involvement. My involvement doesn't end. And a lot of recruiters think that as soon as they've handed over the resume or the CV, and yeah, arrange the interview. That's their accountability level. Well, it's not. It's more than that.
I love this idea of accountability, and it reminds me. So we have a client, Lewis and Jess, at a company called Alinity in Ohio, and they do have I'm pretty sure it's a 12-month guarantee. They've got a really strong guarantee. But what's interesting is, so the recruiting side is only one of their businesses. They also have an HR consulting business. And so that gives them a really interesting perspective because, in fact, it's not just HR consulting. It's really management and it's like more organizational behavior consulting. And what they've designed is they actually prescribe an onboarding process to their clients. And the client has to sign up for and agree to following the onboarding process. And there's responsibilities that the client has, and there's responsibility that the recruiting firm has. And it's a very rigorous onboarding process. And they insist on that in order to get the guarantee, right? Because that way they are involved and ensuring that hire is successful and they get off to a strong start and they are likely to stay with the business, and it does go for the 12 months. So I agree with that totally.
And we have part of that is in part of our contract relationships as well, which we help clients put through. So what your guy, Jess and
Lewis.
Well, yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. They're doing the right thing, but what they're saying, they're making themselves accountable, but also they're making the client accountable. And so one of the things we also do in that is, you know, sometimes it can be as basic as a simple questionnaire that's got a score ratio, you know, and, you know, in the month one, it's like, have you been onboarded correctly? Have you been given your laptop, your cell phone, your whatever? Yeah, it can be basic. And, you know, what the recruiter can do in this case, or the management consultant who specializes in talent acquisition, I prefer to call them, but what they can do is they can actually feedback to client, listen, you don't do something here. You've missed something out. And it might not be the line manager. It might be the person, you know, somebody who's not delivered something for them, and they just get a little bit aggrieved. Oh, you know, this company, they're not very good at doing that. And it's that can just lead to, you know, a bit of discord or breakdown in harmony. And people think, I'm off. I am going to open up. Because one thing I didn't say earlier, Mark, that's really important, that again, when people look at that failure rate, as I call it, that 25%-ish people who don't make that. Why do they fail? You know, and if you ask the employer, you know, why do they fail, it normally comes down to two things. The employee didn't perform, or they didn't fit in. Now, when you then question them back and say, listen, talk to me about your interview process. What in your interview process is trying to assess and evaluate future performance and future fit into the organization? The answer is nothing. So the only thing they're hiring on at the moment is, you know, the resume, which documents the knowledge, skills, and experience. And the employer and the recruiter got that bit right. But that gets it. That only takes you 75% of the way. The other missing part is the things that are not being evaluated. And therefore, you as the recruiter have to say, how can we help you with that? And then how can we be accountable for that to check that some of those things are happening? Because the candidate who becomes the employee, they can do the job. They can do the job. They've got the skills, the knowledge, and experience. That's been verified several times in the interview process. But it's the other parts which can fall down. And if nobody's being accountable for it, unfortunately, it falls through the cracks. And that impacts the organization. Not good for them. It's not good for the candidate because, you know, no candidate takes a job looking to job hop after 6 months. You know, and, you know, even if they've failed in inverted commas in performance, the failure down to performance is because of things that were, could have been corrected or identified or worked on. Or hopefully, I'd go back earlier into the interview process. That candidate was probably the wrong candidate for that organization, but they were just able to perform an interview and deliver the words and the lines in the right times and the right places. We've all done it. But really, they weren't the right fit.
James, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for giving so much value. What's awesome about this is very specific, tangible, tactical insights that you've shared. It's not theory. This is, I think, even just listening to this, people could go away and improve their success rate at client meetings and winning more retained work. So thank you, sir.
No problem. Listen, enjoyable as ever, Mark. I know we probably didn't cover half the things we've got, but just shows how much we've got to talk about and how I think both you and I think one of the things that we both love to do, and I see you do it all the time, and I really do sort of, you know, look out for your podcast, is we love to share. We love to help, educate, and inform. Yes, we're businesses. Yes, we're commercial, of course. But equally, I think you're so giving with the information you share, and I've tried to sort of reciprocate on that side of things as well. Of course, I want people to come and talk to me and see whether we can help them. But if they can take some of those ideas that we shared today and take those away, then great. Put them into practice. They'll be good for you for years to come.
Well, thanks, James. You've definitely delivered on that today. So awesome. I'll look forward to our next conversation.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Good to see you today. Bye-bye.
All right. Fantastic. Tell me, what were your key takeaways from that episode? If you're watching this on YouTube, then please comment below and let me know. I'll tell you what my top three takeaways were. Number one is you need to get the client to attach pain to their current hiring process. Leading with job-filling language keeps recruiters trapped in transactional conversations, whereas leading with hiring outcomes, risk, and retention changes the dynamic of the meeting. Start asking this question in every client meeting. How many of your last 10 hires are still with the company after a year? Okay, takeaway number two is that retained work is often won in the preparation, not the pitch. James shared an example from his brother's marketing agency where they invested serious time, effort, and money preparing tangible materials for a pitch because they wanted the client to feel what it would be like to work with them. The lesson for recruiters is clear. When meetings are harder than ever to secure, turning up underprepared is the fastest way to lose the business. The recruiters who win retained business treat every client meeting like a high-value opportunity, and they prepare accordingly. And my third takeaway was show the value, don't just describe it. James reinforced the idea that words are not enough. Telling the client you have a better process is not going to differentiate you. Showing them will, whether it's examples of your candidate packs, onboarding checkpoints, retention metrics, or how you structure the accountability post-placement. Demonstrating your approach makes the value tangible. And when clients can see and experience what working with you really looks like, then the retained fees start feeling justified. If you found this episode useful, make sure you subscribe to the Resilient Recruiter podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen. And by the way, if you know another recruiter who wants to win more retained work, please go ahead and share this episode with them. I'll see you next time.